Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, a panel of government advisors is meeting to consider clearing the last regulatory hurdle for Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine. Yesterday, the U.S. recorded a painful new record for COVID-19 deaths in a single day, more than 3,000. We'll have more in a few minutes on how one state is responding.
But first, the Federal Trade Commission and 48 attorneys general are taking Facebook to court for its business practices. They say Facebook either buys up its competition like they did with Instagram and WhatsApp or squashes them. And we should note that Facebook is a financial supporter of NPR. New York Attorney General Letitia James is one of the AGs on the case, and she joins me now. Welcome, Attorney General. And first, lay out briefly for us the case you're making in this lawsuit.
Well, first, thank you for having me. And for nearly a decade, you know, Facebook has used its dominance and its monopoly power to destroy the competition so it can take advantage of users and make billions by monetizing personal data into a cash cow and basically to maintain its monopoly power.
I hear your argument, but in the case of Instagram and WhatsApp, the company made these purchases years ago. The government, including antitrust enforcers, reviewed them at the time and found no reason to stop Facebook. So is it fair to undo these deals now?
So the states were not a part of that review. And we think, that the fact that the FTC has filed a separate complaint says a lot about this illegal and unlawful conduct. It's also important to know that these transactions were illegal then, and they are illegal now, and they both lawsuits serve to entrench Facebook's power. I would also add that the harm caused by these illegal transactions has become even more apparent. If you look at the complaint, the two companies that we focus on primarily are Instagram and WhatsApp, but it does not limit it to those two companies. There are a number of companies that they have purchased over the years. Their objective was to maintain their monopoly power and to limit options for their users. And most importantly, the fact is that they changed the terms with respect to data usage. And as a result of that, the privacy protections for users has been compromised. And as a result of that, it's important that we stand up for the marketplace, that we stand up and protect small businesses as well as consumers, and that we put an end to this abuse of monopoly power.
Well, an argument, though, that Facebook is making is that these acquisitions made life better for users and that there's no evidence that rejecting these deals would have increased competition in the industry. So from your view, what's the harm for those who use Facebook and all of its properties? You mentioned the data storage, but yes. These applications, WhatsApp and Instagram, are free.
They're really not free. A lot of people think they're free, but they're not. When individuals use your data, control the content, increase prices for advertisers, ultimately at some point in time, you are paying for their use of your personal data and your privacy. The lack of competition basically has given this company the unchecked power and ability to make changes to consumer privacy protections without their consent. When they first signed up for Facebook, they were promised that they would have privacy protections. That all changed as Facebook grew larger and larger and larger. And ultimately, at some point, there were no other options available for users. And they continued to maintain their monopoly. It means that consumers and users don't get the benefits of innovation and competition when you stifle off upstarts. And it's important to know that a lot of these small companies cannot get investments because investors are just, you know, concerned about the monopoly power of Facebook. And as a result of that, that hurts free enterprise. That hurts creativity and innovation. And that creates the ability, again, to put the power of choice back into the hands of consumers. And that's why 48 attorneys general all across this nation are standing up to challenge this illegal and monopolistic power, which jeopardizes the free market.
That is New York Attorney General Letitia James. Thank you so much for talking with us.
I appreciate you. Have a good day. Thank you.
Well, this week, many governors, including Jay Inslee of Washington State, extended restrictions to try to help stop the post-Thanksgiving surge of COVID-19. And as Congress is stuck on federal coronavirus relief, Inslee is also freeing up more state aid.
We're hoping that Congress can make a bipartisan agreement before the end of this year. But Washington is preparing if they do not.
Let's check in Washington State with Anna Boyko-Wyrock, a reporter with KUOW in Seattle. And Anna, we're reminded that the first reported case of COVID-19 in this country was there back in January. Months later, Washington seemed to get control, doing things like closing nursing homes to families, which seems so horrifying. Now everyone's done it. How dire is it there now?
Well, speaking as a Washingtonian, it's bad. And it's the worst here that it's ever been in the state. And every day it seems like it's getting worse. We saw cases in Washington reach the highest levels even before Thanksgiving. And that's probably because the weather started getting cold and wet and people started spending more time with each other inside. And, you know, it's interesting, Robin, because when you look at a map of COVID across the U.S., Washington is actually doing better than a lot of places. But then if you zoom into our state numbers, it's really troubling what you see. So it's sort of like if you were to take a hike out of Seattle, you know, a map of our mountain ranges. You leave Seattle, you go over a bump, that's March. You go over another bump, that's summer. And now we have this big, steep climb in cases that started at the end of October, and we don't know how high that climb goes.
Well, you also point out something that's probably instructive for all of us. In King County, where you are, you say this has been a tale of two pandemics. Now, you talked to two families. We're going to hear some here. First, in South King County, Alicia Sanchez told you she and her whole family had COVID-19 after her son brought it home from the warehouse where he works.
Just imagine, I was sick and all my children were sick. It was worrying. And they were really worried about me because since I have diabetes, they thought I might get really sick.
Well, meanwhile, Anna, in Northeast King County, David Johnston told you that life hasn't really changed much for him and his family.
COVID hasn't actually affected us very much. I'm retired. My wife was already working from home. And my son was in high school. Now he's in college, but he's still upstairs in his bedroom.
And a great comparison there. Tell us more about what you're learning about the inequity of the pandemic in King County.
Yeah. So my colleague Eilish O'Neill and I fanned out across the county and we went and talked to these folks who were in places that had the lowest rates and the highest rates of COVID in the county. And so even within this county, which is actually where Seattle is, you have some regions in the south that have seven or eight times the rate of infection compared to areas, you know, half an hour drive away. And the way the virus is spreading from person to person also depends on the area. So, for example, people in the area around SeaTac Airport, if you've ever flown into Seattle, people in that area were most likely to get COVID while they're at work or from a family member. And that's because many people in those areas work in essential jobs and live with multiple generations under one roof, like you heard earlier. And meanwhile, people in North Seattle were most likely to get COVID from social gatherings or being out and about in the community. And that's because people in those areas are just more likely to have jobs where they can work from home. And so this difference shows some people have the choice to keep themselves farther away from the virus and some people don't.
Yeah, if you're annoyed about working from home, as many of us are, we have to be reminded that's a luxury. We should be grateful. Your governor, Jay Inslee, announced that some of the restrictions he's rolled out will extend for the next few weeks. So just briefly, what do they entail?
So you can't go inside a restaurant to eat, no going to a gym, bowling alley, museum. You can't get together with folks from outside your household unless you quarantine and get tested, and the size of religious services is also capped.
Yeah, and he's also approved $50 million in grants to help people in the coming weeks. And who's that going to?
Well, so that's going to the businesses who are most impacted by those restrictions. So restaurants and fitness centers, like I mentioned, also music venues, event venues, which have really been struggling in the pandemic. And those places can get up to $20,000 each to cover expenses connected to the pandemic.
Yeah. And just briefly, only have about a half a minute. What are you going to follow in the next weeks?
Well, I'm really looking at the vaccine rollout here. So, you know, we could get doses for the first vaccinations next week, going to healthcare workers. And, you know, it strikes me, like you said, this region was one of the first epicenters of the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. And now those places that were really hit with the first wave are going to start getting vaccinations very soon. And it feels like we're coming full circle.
We'll follow it. Anna Boyko-Ryrock of KUOW in Seattle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer? If I had my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart.
Ew. That, of course, a selection from Charles Dickens' holiday classic, A Christmas Carol, performed by Charity Jones of the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Dozens of theaters across the country stage some version of the Dickens novella about the miser Scrooge and his redemption through visits with the ghosts of Christmas past and future, who show him his impact on his town and families like the Cratchits and poor Tiny Tim. Yes, it was inspiration for It's a Wonderful Life. And every December, attending readings or performances of A Christmas Carol are a holiday ritual. We do one at our mother station, WBUR. But we've gone virtual this year, as has the Guthrie in Minneapolis, as has most theaters. Let's talk about how that works. Joseph Hodge directed the Guthrie Theater production in Minneapolis. He joins us. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here with you.
Nice to have you. And Brandon Weinbrenner is directing a virtual Christmas Carol at the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas. Brandon, nice to speak with you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And Kirk Columbus is here. He's directing his production at the Trinity Repertory Company in Providence, Rhode Island. Kurt, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And Joseph Hodge there in Minneapolis, your version of A Christmas Carol was filmed on a stage at the Guthrie. We just heard the sound effects. First of all, remind people how these are done. Sometimes there's individuals doing sort of a book, you know, a chapter of the story. Sometimes there's more staging. How is it done?
Typically, this would have been our 46th year if we were doing it in its traditional fashion, which is some 40 actors in a very, very big scale event that happens in the largest of our theaters, which is an 1,100 seat thrust stage. But this year, things being what they are, we didn't want to take the year off and we wanted to do something. So what we did is we took Dickens' novella is written in five chapters, or staves, as Dickens calls them. And for his own reading performance tour, which he did, and including in America in 1868, he adapted his own novella for his own readings of the script. So we thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to take that performance script that Dickens had written for himself, adapted for himself, give one of those staves to each of four different actors. We never played it in front of a live audience, and we made a film.
Well, a couple of things. You mentioned Dickens' reading tour, 1867 to 68, and he did part of it at the Parker House in Boston, which is where our station here in Boston, we do our reading there, and you know, you can see the mirror that he practiced in front of, and we do it in the same room he did it in, and it's really quite something. But you normally fully stage it like it's a theater production.
Oh, fully stage, a huge scale event, yes, with all the scenery and all the automation and flying ghosts and all of that. And so in this film that we've made, no, it's a much, 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 to state the obvious, a wildly different event.
Yeah, so you have one actor at a time filming and doing a reading of part of the book. Brandon Weinbrenner at the Alley Theater there in Houston, you shot yours entirely on Zoom. How'd that go?
So yes, very different than the Guthrie approach. We decided to go contactless so that the actors who were in the production never had to be around each other or anyone else, but rather filmed the entirety of their portion in their homes. So we have a resident acting company at the Alley of 8 actors. So we used them and 2 other actors in the Houston community to comprise a 10-person cast. And in this production, it centers on a traveling troupe of actors who have lost their Scrooge and their Tiny Tim, who don't have all their props or their costumes, and they're having to make do to tell the story. So we thought that was perfectly apt for our approach to telling the story of A Christmas Carol in a distant virtual way. So yes, we rented each of the actors a high quality Canon camera and were able to send to the actors in their homes the camera, lighting equipment, sound equipment, costumes, props, a few suggestive scenery items. They were able to plug their camera and their microphone into their laptops so that we could rehearse and record through Zoom, but we would see the high quality feed from their camera on Zoom as opposed to the camera from their laptop.
Well, I should say it helps that a couple of your actors are married and they can play Mr. and Mrs. Cratchit, Bob Cratchit, that's Scrooge's beleaguered employee and his wife. And in many readings, one person will do both. That's the part of the reading that I do. So, my dear, said Bob, the children, Christmas Day. It should be Christmas Day, I am sure, said she, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. Here are your pros, though, Chris Hutchinson and Elizabeth Bunch.
Look at this wonderful table, Tim. Oh, and here comes Peter mashing the potatoes with incredible vigor, and here is Belinda sticking her finger in the applesauce.
Are all the plates dusted? Yes, Mother. And are all the places set?
One napkin short, Mother.
Then you'll have to share with your sister.
I don't want to share with her.
And that was all on Zoom.
Yeah, we were very fortunate to have Chris and Elizabeth as married company members. And I'll up the ante even and say that the young man who played our prop boy / Tiny Tim is their son, Mac Hutchison, who many years ago played Tiny Tim in our production. He's grown older, but it was too good an opportunity to pass up having the entire Cratchit family be able to be on screen together in their home because they're family members.
Kirk Columbus of Trinity Rep there in Providence, you also had a couple playing the Cratchit, slightly different.
Right. I had a Bob Cratchit, and he and his husband are responsible for the education of their niece right now. And so they became the Cratchits, and Evelyn played Tiny Tim. So we were able to similarly film people in their home environments for the scenes where they had to be in scene together. And then we've created, Robin, basically a whole movie setup for Scrooge's home, which is in our theater. We watch him walk home through the streets of Providence and arrive at Trinity Rep because, as we say, Scrooge lives at Trinity Rep at this time of year. And our audiences who have been coming for 43 years and who make this a tradition every year also want to see the theater because that's part of their experience of coming to see this show. So there are a couple of magical surprises in there.
Yeah, they haven't been able to be in the theater, so you take them in. But as you said, you also take them into the actors' homes so that they can interact with their pods, right? The people that they've been living with. You have a Mr. Cratchit, Bob, with his husband. But yes, let's also listen to a little of your production. This is Joseph Wilson as Scrooge, revisiting his childhood with the ghost of Christmas past, played here by Rebecca Gibble.
Your lip is trembling. And what is that upon your cheek?
It's a pimple. It's nothing. Lead me where you will.
Do you remember the way?
Remember it? I could walk it blindfolded.
Strange to have forgotten it for so many years.
And Kurt, you do what sounds like a wonderful thing with Scrooge. This is within a storybook?
Yes. What we wanted to do, Robin, was to find a way to bring this whole stave to past to life. And we turned it into a children's storybook. So the ghost takes Scrooge and he turns into a little cutout and he gets put into the storybook. And then the images come on screen.
Yeah, just wonderful. This is such a gift to the communities. Why do you think it's so enduring, Joseph?
Yeah, well, you know, December 19th, which is when our version will go live to the public, will be the 177th anniversary of the publication date of Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And this is a story that hasn't been out of public view in 177 years. And it's been adapted for the stage, it's been adapted for dance, it's been adapted for Mr. Magoo, it's been adapted for the Muppets. I mean, the thing has such an incredible power and life of its own. The story itself, it calls us to our better selves. And we just made a strong decision that we weren't going to sit it out this year. We were going to find a way to do it because the story remains really necessary now.
And this is Kurt in Rhode Island. I want to add in on what Joe was saying. We just felt this was a year when a story about a guy who had been in a self-imposed isolation stepped out and realized that the rest of the world was what he needed in order to be alive. And so, you know, that seemed like it was so urgent. And I think worldwide, this story still has just an incredible weight, resonance, fruitfulness. And so we're just lucky to be doing it.
Yeah. Brandon, there in Houston.
It is astonishing to me how often audiences want to revisit the story every single year. It's that resilience and that constant coming back that really fills us with the need to tell this story now and tell it any way we can. Maybe the medium and how we're telling the story has changed, but the story itself remains the same. And that's the story that our audiences want to see and can reflect upon this holiday season.
Brandon Weinbrenner of the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas. Before that, Kurt Columbus of Trinity Repertory Company in Providence, Rhode Island. Joseph Hodge of the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you all, and to all a good night.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
Actually, that's the wrong story. But anyway, we'll have links to the virtual Christmas carols at hearnow.org. By the way, the Guthrie is about $10. The other two are free. All are free for kids. It's at hearnow.org.
About $8 million. That's how much the city of Minneapolis has decided to cut from its police budget for the upcoming year. The overall budget for the city's department last year was about $193 million. The money saved, the city says, will be used to train a new class of professionals to handle mental health calls as well as reports of theft and property damage. For more, let's bring in Brant Williams from Minnesota Public Radio, who is reporting the story late into the night. Hello, Brant.
Glad to be here.
I want to get a sense of how people there are reacting to these cuts, both police officers and protesters who made the defund the police hashtag a national rallying cry after George Floyd was killed.
Well, there's been a lot of response, especially from the public. The city council has held three public hearings leading up to this budget vote, and it spanned about 18 hours worth of and hundreds of people speaking. And there's been people who've said, look, there's a crime wave going on right now. This is not a good time to reduce resources for the police department. You know, carjacking's going way up. More than 500 people have been shot and wounded in the city. And the number of homicides here has reached, is getting near the level of the Murderapolis year in 1995. So they said, now's not a good time to reduce the police budget, and said, you know, hey, we should give the chief all the resources he needs. But there's others who are saying, look, traditional policing has not helped keep people safe. Police officers don't actually prevent the crimes. They only arrive after these things have happened. And by the way, like as with George Floyd, people of color have been the targets traditionally of police violence and killings. So this has been going on for a bit. It came to a head last night during this vote, but it passed. And we'll have to see what happens as far as Mayor Fry, if he's going to go ahead and sign this budget or if he's going to veto it.
No police officers will lose their jobs as part of these cuts, but put these numbers into perspective. What police programs are impacted by a nearly $8 million cut from a $193 million budget?
Well, as you mentioned, yes, no officers are going to lose their jobs. But what this budget plan does is it moves several civilian employees out of the police department and into other departments of the city. And this has been a sore spot because these are civilian employees who do things like community connections. They're called community navigators. There's another group called community crime prevention specialists. These are people who deal directly with the public. They're under the police department. They're also diverse employees, and folks who oppose this move say this takes these types of people who make connections with the public out of the police department. And it's something that they've been trying to, over the years, restore connections with communities of color in the city. So these are the types of jobs that are going to be out of the police department in 2021. And as I mentioned, it's been kind of a cause for consternation for some folks in the police department as well.
As I mentioned, this money will be used to train people to handle mental health crises and theft calls. Could you have seen this measure pass 5 years ago?
Actually, yes. Because the council has been working towards trying to do these types of changes for a while now. But this year, again, with the killing of George Floyd, it just basically accelerated all those plans.
That's Brant Williams, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We know the pandemic is taking a toll on healthcare workers who've spent months putting themselves and their families at risk, watching colleagues get sick or die, watching patients die, often holding their hand or an iPad so they can talk to the family that can't come in. Psychiatrist Mona Massoud started thinking about that toll early in the pandemic and created the National Physician Support Line, an anonymous call center where healthcare workers find a sympathetic professional ear and can talk for as long as they need to. And they are. Dr. Massoud joins us now. Dr. Massoud, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Also joining us, psychiatrist Nancy Berkey, who practices in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and volunteers on the hotline. Dr. Berkey, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, we can't wait to hear what you're hearing. But Dr. Massoud, how does it work?
It is staffed all by volunteer psychiatrists, and this is a nationwide service that is unapologetically created for physicians. Because physicians, you may have heard this, you know, it's almost become cliche amongst our circles that physicians are the worst patients. Because we feel that how can we support or take care or heal other people when we ourselves are unwell? It feels so antithetical to all of the expectations of what physicians do. And so it's very hard for physicians to admit that they need help too.
Well, and they save people. You know, to not do that is failure, although we know that's not right. True, but that, you know, to do your best is all we ask, and yet that's probably how it feels. So hold your thought, Dr. Massoud, because I want to hear what you're hearing. Dr. Berkey, so many calls coming in. You've taken 700. Who's calling? What are they saying?
Well, they're a very diverse group. They're from all states. They're from all specialties. But these docs all start the conversation with an apology. You know, I'm so sorry to bother you. I don't want to waste your time, because they're just so humble.
Well, and what are they saying? I mean, we have a colleague, you know, her husband has to strip in the garage for fear he'll bring COVID-19 home to the family. Tell us what you're hearing.
From medical students through senior attendings, what they're talking about is that they are quite used to death and suffering, having to deliver bad news. That is part of the job of being a physician. But this pandemic, the magnitude, the intensity, the risk for themselves and their families. You know, you mentioned people who've had to live in garages. I talked to people who've been in another part of the house, not able to be in the same room as their spouse for the last 7 months with nothing, you know, in sight. One doc was telling me, you know, he'd come from a 12-hour shift in the ER, and difficulty transferring people to the ICU because there's no available beds in his hospital, can't get them to another hospital. You've heard these stories. Multiple intubations in the emergency room. Finally, he gets his PPE off and is going to drive home, driving down the street. And what does he see? He sees people in the street, in the parks, outside restaurants, without masks, not social distancing. Mm-hmm. And he's just dumbstruck, feeling such an enormous disappointment that's really taken its toll.
Well, Dr. Masood, I want to ask you about that. Is that a part of it, that they feel like they're in a separate reality?
Yes, exactly. They do feel like there are two worlds that they're having to navigate. And the thing that has been the most shocking for them has been this dual narrative of being called heroes. They can't wrap their heads around being called heroes. And the reason is not out of humility. The concept of heroism carries so much pressure. It doesn't allow vulnerability. Heroes have superpowers. You are not allowed to express that you're tired, you're exhausted, that you're yourself afraid of this virus. And so they have the immense responsibility of, you know, wearing not only their mask, literally nowadays, but also of wearing the mask of bravery and courage, which internally that they may not feel.
And Dr. Berkey, we know another thing almost unique to this is that family members can't come in. What are physicians and nurses going through when it comes to not being able to let family members in to see their loved ones?
What happens is nurses, respiratory therapists, docs, everybody are aware that the family has always played a very important role in a hospital. I remember one doc was talking to me about he had seen prior to the pandemic the very moving and impactful death of a neighbor in which the family surrounded this neighbor and really supported him and was able to carry him in to his death. And then, you know, turn the corner, it's a pandemic, and this doc is now telling family members that they cannot go in with their beloved father or whatever, and knowing that they may never see that person again. Mm-hmm. And he was having to be the policeman saying, no, you cannot come in, even though he knew in his head that that was right, in his heart, it was such a violation of what he thought was correct. And I think about him a lot and how it just went against his values and moral belief, even though he knew it was the right thing to do for science.
Yeah. Dr. Masood, how many calls do you think you've had?
At this point, we have had over 1,500 calls, anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour and a half each. And of course, as you can imagine, Robin, they correlate with the surges. Doctors are also affected by the politics and the election and also with various social justice movements.
We all heard early on the terrible story of the emergency room doctor who took her own life. I don't know if you've lost anyone, you know. I don't know if, and I don't know if you want to share that, but do you feel you've saved someone? Dr. Berkey?
That's a tough question. We have the ability to obtain help if we need to. If I'm on the call with someone who I think is actively suicidal, then the physician support line gives me backup, which I really, really appreciate, obviously. I have talked to docs who have lost friends to suicide, or one who lost a father-in-law to suicide who is a physician. And so, you know, it is a very hot topic that we discuss a lot within our group.
For a psychiatrist, that's our heart attack, that's our stroke, that's our worst case scenario. It is a topic that on our weekly debriefs with our psychiatrists that run the line that we talk about quite often. We have all known a colleague. We have lost either by suicide or has suffered from a mental health struggle. We do have one of the highest rates of suicide of all professions. But even that being said, it's not normalized. And a lot of it has to do with the medical culture that I spoke to at the beginning of our conversation today.
Can I add something? I think short of the suicide is my concern about what is happening in regard to a kind of hopelessness that we do hear about, the physicians that call us. And what I'm concerned about is that a lot of docs will not leave the practice of medicine during a pandemic. It's just not in their bones. But a lot of them are talking to us about leaving afterwards, and I worry about that. And I remember a call I just had where a doc who is just a brilliant person, it was just obvious, and he talked about wanting to leave afterwards. And I said to him that, of course, you need to do what is in your own best interest. But it's important that you know that if you were to leave medicine, it would be a great loss to all of us, a great loss to community. And there was a silence on the phone. And then he said very quietly, just whispered, "Can you please say that again?" You know, he just needed to hear it. And it's not as if he hadn't heard it before. It was just something about this call and his needing to know that he was important that I think gets lost in the pandemic and in the, like Mona talks about, the alienation that calling them heroes creates, but that a different kind of connection can help us keep our medical community healthy and working beyond the pandemic.
Yeah. Oh, that's a successful call, I would think.
Yeah.
That's psychiatrist Nancy Berkey, who's been taking calls at the physician support line that Dr. Mona Massoud, a Philadelphia area psychiatrist, set up in March. We're going to link you to all of this at herenow.org. Dr. Berkey is from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I want to thank you both so much for what you're doing and for talking to us about it. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
It's been an honor to be on this with you, Robin. Thank you.
And we also have a link to the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at herenow.org.
Two of the oldest rivalries in college football won't be playing together this weekend because of the pandemic. Indiana and Purdue compete every fall for the trophy, the Old Oaken Bucket. They had to call their game off recently because of COVID-19 cases at both schools. And this is a big deal because this game has been played every year since 1919. This weekend's Ohio State-Michigan game is also canceled for the first time since 1917. Mike Pesca is sports analyst for Here and Now. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, these are all Big Ten games. How do these cancellations affect the conference championship and the college football playoffs?
The Big Ten had to tweak a rule. They had been sticking to the idea that all teams had to play six games to be eligible for the conference championship. But once that rule, if followed, would dictate that Ohio State, one of the four best teams in college football, couldn't play for its own conference championship, they amended the rule, and therefore they're going to go by you could play five games. Ohio State will be in the championship against Northwestern. It is like Jane McManus, who's at Marist, says, sports are a reward for a functioning society. And when society hits all these glitches, of course, sports is going to follow.
Wow, that's really powerful. That's actually a powerful, when you say it like that. You know, I've lost count of how many college football games have been canceled because of this pandemic. Does college basketball have the same problem, canceling games or shutting teams down?
Oh, well, I can inform you it's been 124 games that are postponed or canceled in college football. College basketball faces, in fact, kind of a bigger problem because there are more than twice as many big-time college basketball programs, although fewer players on every team. And yeah, I mean, the biggest factor and the biggest difference is college basketball is just playing at a different time, and the pandemic will be having different spikes, and maybe a vaccine will be able to see some effect around the time March, maybe hopefully around the time March Madness was to hit. But even Mike Krzyzewski, the most accomplished coach in the NCAA, is talking this week about really looking at it, assessing the physical and mental health of the players, and, you know, maybe suspending some play if that's what's necessary.
Let's touch on pro sports for a minute, because they make their money from ticket sales. And of course, for the most part, there are no tickets being sold because fans aren't allowed in the stadiums. But the NBA is actually stepping in to help its teams. Tell us more about that.
Right. So the NBA estimates that 40% of its revenues come from in-game and arena sales. And of course, because the season was truncated, they hit hard times, and also building that bubble, though effective, cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So teams, it's not that they're not paying their players, but they have had trouble making payroll, front office. And there was this cycle where some teams were laying off staff, and then there'd be a blowback on social media, and they'd rehire them. It was all embarrassing and untenable. They went out and got loans. So they're giving each team $30 million to sort of protect against liquidity, paying people, paying vendors, keeping the lights on. And the reason they were able to secure this is, though, even though the NBA has cash flow problems, unlike all other businesses, the underlying worth of their franchises, because of supply and demand and how many billionaires would pay almost anything to own an NBA franchise, that's not being threatened. So there's no thought that long term the NBA will be in trouble. So they got a loan, and they secured a loan to make sure that in the short term they're not as in as much trouble as they could have been.
I see. Mike, I'm still thinking about that quote that sports is a reward for a functioning society. I mean, that really says everything right there. But there's just a lot of sports news this week, too. The International Olympic Committee has added breakdancing as a medal sport in the 2024 Games in Paris. Your thoughts on this?
I love it. First of all, and this has gone unnoticed, when you tell people breakdancing is a sport, they say it's a sport, and compare it to ice dancing, compare it to a lot of other competitions that are based on subjective judgment. Sure, it can be a sport. And also, the history of breakdancing is that it always began with battles, street crews. So it was always competitive. It wasn't just like taking ballroom dancing and layering the idea of a competition on top of it. But also, this has gone unnoticed. You know, you guys there in Massachusetts, the state's invented at least two Olympic sports I could think of, basketball and volleyball. New York City had never invented an Olympic sport, to my knowledge. Here comes breakdancing. And I predict it's going to be incredibly popular, because when you think about the sports that people love to watch on TV, breakdancing has it all, including the faces of people we could see outside of equipment and helmets. I really think it's going to be quite a phenomenon in Paris 2024.
I actually think you're right. I mean, what entertainment that will be to be able to see folks
breakdancing. And what a soundtrack.
What a soundtrack, too.
Yeah.
I think there'll be music, albums that will come out of this solely because of that. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thank you so much, Mike.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
In L.A., which invented skateboarding, I'm Robin Young.
Right?
Here and Now.
I know.